Okay, so should I begin?
Alright, someone is timing?
Yeah, I'm doing.
Okay, thank you.
So you start?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, good afternoon everybody. I'll be presenting BORG, which is a system that uses block reorganization to improve performance, the IoT performance. This work is in collaboration with Jorge Guerra and Luis Iseshi from Florida International University, Sam Bernard, who's now at Georgia Tech, Jason, who was in Syracuse University at the time, and our advisors, Dr. Rajat Rangaswamy and whatever. This is our motivation. As you know, when we access a file or when we open an application, we have to wait for the IOs to complete until the data is completely loaded into the memory. This is because of the existing implementations of the file systems, which favor sequential accesses. They tend to store data sequentially on the file, and so sequential accesses to the file are our favorite. In reality, workloads do not have sequential accesses to data. Most of them may have non-sequential accesses. Because of this, there's a mismatch between the workload access patterns and the layout policies of underlying file systems. So one solution to this problem is to reorganize the data on the disk based on the workload access pattern. This is the principle behind BORG. So in a nutshell, BORG uses identifies block access patterns in the workload. It identifies the blocks or the hard blocks that are frequently accessed in the workload. It manages a separate dedicated partition, which we call the BOPT, or the BORG optimized partition, where the hot blocks are stored or copied. This partition is divided into two regions. One is the read cache and one is the write buffer. The read cache contains all the hot blocks, and the write buffer assimilates all the new write requests that come in. This partition can be configured by the system administrator. In addition to this, BORG operates in the background, so it has minimal impact on the foreground IOs. It is implemented as a Linux module, so it can be inserted or removed whenever required. Can you see?
Yeah, I see.
And it is independent of the file system above it. It's implemented in the block layer in the sort of section. It is independent of any file system. It can be used without modifications to any file system. So before we go to the architecture of BORG, we will talk about, I'll first motivate the design of BORG based on the workload characteristics. So we focus on three workload characteristics. The first one is non-uniform access frequency distribution, which means that the distribution of accesses for popular data is not uniform on the disk. At any given time, only a small region of the disk contains the popular data. The second is partial determinism, which means that non-sequential block access patterns also tend to repeat along with sequential accesses. And third is temporal locality, which means that the working set remains static over some duration of time in a given workflow. So we empirically evaluate each of these our workload characteristics to see how both can be motivated with this. We use four different workloads, two end-user workloads, that is the office and the developer workloads, and two server workloads, which is the SDN and the web server workloads. The office workload consists of office applications normally used, like doing for open office applications or the browser. The developer workload is an environment used by a research developer, and the applications use their GDB or LaTeX and Emacs and so on. For the SDN server, it's a multi-user application. It's a multi-user workload, and it's the SDN server for the document and the code base in our research lab. And the web server is our department, the middle of our department web server. So it middles all the requests that were handled by our department web server in a week. The first column in the table shows the workload type. The second column shows the total file system that was the amount of file system that was active. The third and the fourth column shows the amount of reads and writes in the workload. And the final finally the last column shows the size of the memory of the host. As you can see, the developer and the SVN workloads are more write intensive. The write, there are more writes for SVN and the developer workloads, whereas the office and the web server workloads are more read dominant. So let's go to the first characteristic that we discussed in the non-uniform access frequency distribution. In this table, the first, the second column shows the percentage of the total file system access. So as you can see, the total file system access is between 4.5% to about 22% for each of the workflows of the total file system. The next column shows the top 20% data access, which is the most popular data in the top 20% of the total file system access. So, which is again about between 45% to 60% of total accesses. Also, this figure here shows the heat map for the web server workload. The different cells here represent the different regions on the disk type, and the different shapes represent the frequency of data access in that region. The darker shapes correspond to more frequent accesses in that region. So as you can see here, the as you can see, the accesses are spread across all over the disk. So with these results, we can conclude that by co-locating the most frequently accessed data, we can obtain some improvement in data performance. We now go to the next characteristic, that is partial determinism. This is measured by measuring the accesses between the non-sequential accesses that occur, that access patterns that occur more than once in the week-long trace. These are the results for the partial determinism. As you can see, it's high in most cases, especially for the office workload, and it's lower for the web server workload. With this, we can conclude that we can block access patterns for optimizing layout, and this can in turn increase performance. Finally, the temporal locality. This shows the temporal locality for, again, the web server workload. In here, the two bars represent the accesses. The first bar represents all the accesses for a given day, and the second bar represents the top 20 or the most popular accesses of that day. On the x-axis, we have 7 days of the week, and all the subsequent so 7 days of the week, and that they show the overlap with the first day in the week. Day 2 to day 7 show overlap in the first day of the week. As you can see, there's substantial overlap in all the accesses for the first day of the week. Also, for the top 20% accesses, there is substantial overlap, which means that the popular data also can be using this information of the popular data, we can also again increase performance. It should be noted here, for both the temporal locality and the partial determinism, although the graph shown here for the web servers, it's common across all the observers. We now go to the system architecture of Borg. As we mentioned before, Borg is inserted at the block layer of the storage stack. It contains of 3 kernel space components and 2 user space components. The kernel space components are the IO profiler, the OCP space reconfigurator, and the IO indirector. The user space components are the analyzer and planner. The IO profiler collects traces of all the block accesses, and it passes the traces to the analyzer. Based on these traces, the analyzer creates a graph, which is an input to the planner. The planner uses this graph to create a plan, a layout plan, and the reconfigurator uses this plan to copy the data from the OTP to from the file system to the OTP space. Also, once the reconfiguration is done, the IO indirector is responsible for redirecting all requests to the OTP space. Let's look into a little more details of each of these components. The IO profiler is is locked, the other operation is locked with all the three attributes, the temporal attribute, the processor attribute, and the block level attribute for the IO. In the temporal attribute, we lock the timestamp, which gives us the sequence of blocks that are accessed. The process level attribute gives us the different blocks that are associated with each process, and the block level attribute actually gives us the actual IOs that are accessed and whether the operation is read or write. Next, the user space component, analyzer and planner. And the analyzer uses the trace from the IO profiler and builds a process, per process graph. Each node in the graph is an LDA range, and the edge represents, the edge direction represents the temporal dependence between the two LDA ranges. The edge weight represents the frequency between the two LDA ranges. All these process, per process graphs are then merged into one master axis graph, which is the output of the analyzer and the input of the planner component. The planner then creates a layout based on the graph. It chooses the most connected node in the graph for the initial placement. Once this node has been placed, or once this node has been allocated a BOPP LDA, it chooses subsequent nodes based on their edge weights to the already connected or the already allocated node, and places it and chooses allocates the placement based on the direction of the edge that's connected. Next, the OPT space reconfigurator. The planner writes the plan the planner creates the plan which has the OPT and the which has the mapping between the file system and the OPT block. The reconfigurator reads the plan from the planner. The planner first writes all the leaving components, that is, all the components that are first that have to be moved out of the OPT. This happens only for multiple reconfigurations. For the first reconfiguration, there is no leaving component. It then writes the relocate component, that is the blocks that have to be relocated within the OPT space. Again, this is only for the for the second or the subsequent reconfiguration, not for the first one. And finally, it writes all the incoming components. That is the component that, the incoming block, that is the block that has to be copied from the file system to the BOPP space. And finally, the IO indirector. The indirector is responsible for directing all the new requests that come in after the reconfiguration to the OPT, the OPT space if they are located in the BOPT. For instance, here in this case, request B comes in, the IO indirector checks the board map, that's the data structure that board mentions. It contains the mapping between the SS and the OPT block and also mentions the information. So it checks in the board map if the LDA exists in the board map. If it does, then it services it from the BOPT space. If the LDA does not exist in the map, as in this case, then it services it from the original location in the file system. In case of new writes that are not in the file system space, it creates a map entry in the board map data structure, and it writes this data to the OPT write buffer space. So let's move on to the evaluation. In the evaluation of work to see how well work performs with all these workloads, we use the total disk busy time as a metric. All the hosts that we use implement the Linux 2.6 kernel, and we experiment with two different file systems of the DriveRepress and the ESC2. We do different experiments here. One is a web server experiment. We also do trace to place for the SVM server and the developer workload. We also evaluate Borg with virtual machines to see how Borg impacts performance in virtual machines. We also measure the startup profiles of different applications to see the impact of Borg on IO startup times of the application. And then we do a sensitivity analysis for different parameters in Borg, different configurable parameters of Borg. So first for the web server, this figure shows the disk busy time in the web server. The first bar shows the time for the vanilla system, which does not use Borg. The second bar shows the effect of Borg the cumulative traces. Cumulative meaning traces that are used starting that are used from the beginning of the experiment. The third graph shows the effect of work on partial traces, that is traces that are used just from the subsequent from the previous reconfiguration. On the x-axis, the tabs N1 to N5 mean the non-reconfiguration phases. N1 has no reconfiguration done, that's the training period, and N2 to N5 occur after reconfiguration, which means that in this case we have four different reconfigurations. The web server workload has about 1 million requests with about 250,000 files. And the OPD size we use here is 8 gigabytes, which is less than 5% of the total file system access by the web server. So to summarize the results, you can see that the work reduces the disk busy time between 14 to 35% for the cumulative traces. It also reduces the time for the partial traces, except in N5, where there's an increase in the cumulative time. This is because of the change in workload, and this does not affect the partial traces. Affect the partial traces because it already contains the change because it's based on the previous because traces are from the previous reconfiguration. This graph shows the busy times during the reconfiguration period. As I said before, we have four reconfigurations. To summarize this result, we have higher reconfiguration busy times during the reconfiguration for Borg because it does more copying activities and there are more greater overheads. But overall, in spite of this higher busy times, overall Borg still improves the performance by 14% for the cumulative and 18% for the partial traces. These are the overheads that Borg incurs. As you can see here, overhead for this graph shows the overhead for both the cumulative and the partial traces. The stacks bar, each of the stacks in the bar shows the overhead for the reconfigurator component, the planner component, and the analyzer component. As you can see, the cumulative traces overhead increase linearly, because the working set increases with each reconfiguration as the workload is. And this is because the current implementation of the analyzer and planner component do not use results from previous reconfiguration of previous plan. And there is still room for improvement in the analyzer and planner component. We also did a trace replay for the SNM developer workload. I'll just summarize the results here. The BOPT size we use is 2 gigabytes, and the write buffer was 20% of file system size for the SVN and 40% for the developer workload. This is a summary of the results. So as you can see, for the SVN workload, there's up to a 45% decrease in busy time, and for the developer workload, there's up to 60% decrease in the busy time. We also measured the startup time for Borg, the startup times of the virtual machines with Borg. We used four virtual machines for the training, and we trained Borg on the startup profile of each of these virtual machines. And we noted that there was a 3x times improvement after Borg in the startup time. We also ran the postmark benchmark on the virtual machine to see how they perform within the virtual machine, and this is the result of the postmark benchmark. As you can see here, the Borg does not show a very great improvement here. The average reduction is only about 6% of Borg in the non-reconfiguration phases, and this is because there is no process context inside the VM, so the sequential data can be made non-sequential because of Borg, which can reduce the performance. We also measured the startup profile of different applications. We trained the system for about 4 hours on various IO intensive applications. And we measured the startup profile of some of these. The applications in this table that were used in the training were only the first five applications, Firefox to Eclipse. GIMP and OMFS will not use in training. So for the applications that are used in the training, Borg showed improvement up to 67%. OMFS also showed improvement because it uses some shared libraries with OLiDs. And GIMP also does not use, it still shows a small improvement. We also did a sensitivity study for the different workloads, for the different configuration parameters, for the different configuration parameters that Borg uses. The first is the deconfiguration interval, second is the OPD size, and third is the write buffer size in the BOPT. So for the reconfiguration interval, we used two workloads, the SDN and the developer workload. And we changed the reconfiguration interval from 8 hours to 3 hours. We varied the reconfiguration interval from 8 hours to 3 hours. And in this case, the VOPT size was set to 1 gigabyte, and the write buffer was 50% of the VOPT size. This is just to bootstrap the experiment. It was observed that as the reconfiguration interval increases, the developer workload showed increase in performance. This is because it could predict better access patterns based on more information on the working set. But for SDN, because of the rapidly changing workload, as the reconfiguration interval increases, it actually decreases performance. We used the best reconfiguration interval from the previous experiment for both the developer and the SDN workload, and varied the OPT size from 256 megabytes to about 80 gigabytes here in the next experiment. The BOPT write buffer size is again 50% of the total OPT size. In this case, the performance for the SDN workload did not change much because it has a small working set and most of the blocks are already in the OPT. Allocated in the VOPT, even the 256 gigabytes of, 256 megabytes of the VOPT size. But for the developer workload, as the OPT size increased, the performance increased until it peaked at the point, which was about 50%, which was about 4 gigabytes. And thereafter, the performance decreased because the size of the leaf cache decreased, which degraded the performance. As before, we used the results from this previous experiment for the VOPT size and used the OPT size of 2 gigabytes for the developer workload and for the SDN workload. In this case, we varied the write buffer size from 0 to 100%. And again, as before, the write performance decreased when the size was when there was not enough space in the BOPT to assimilate all the write requests. So here we can conclude that incorrect parameter configuration can degrade performance in Borg. Whereas if correctly configured, Borg can improve performance. In this case, the maximum performance improvement is actually. To conclude, Borg improves the sequentiality because it restricts the movement of the head and it co-locates all the frequency access data. The busy times reduced from range from 5 to 60% for the different workloads. It adapts well to constantly changing write intensive workloads because it absorbs all the write requests in stride buffer as in case of the SDN workload. The overheads, as you can see, are an acceptable limit. And Borg still has to be improved in several, it can still be improved in several directions. One of them that I mentioned before is the analyzer and the standard operations. There's also the collection of the reconfigurable parameters can also be automated in Borg. And also the reconfiguration interval right now is fixed, which can be again automated in the future.
Okay. 26.
Okay,
good. The average.
Can we start asking questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So what's the ratio between the how much time does the reconfiguration take? Because you show on, let me see, 25, slide 25.
This one?
Yeah, you show, no, 25. It's 25? 25, yeah. Okay, so, yeah. You show four reconfigurations occurring, and then you on the previous slide, you showed the normal phase of the previous.
Right. This is the non-reconfiguration phase.
So, yeah, so how much time does the reconfiguration take in comparison with the normal? Because we see that in the normal phase you gain more performance, but in the reconfiguration you lose. You're actually performing worse than the vanilla phase.
Okay, so how much time does the reconfiguration take?
Yes.
Think of this as a question from an audience of staff.
Yeah, that's
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to look at that question from that respect, not a question from George.
Okay. Okay.
You can ask for clarification.
Okay. So, can you repeat the question again?
Okay, so the thing is that your system has, during normal time, it can see that it performs better than the vanilla case, but during reconfiguration times, it performs worse.
Okay.
So, I want to know how much time does the reconfiguration take in comparison to this normal time? Did I explain myself?
How long will,
yeah,
will system be reconfiguring? Since this time it's not performed by the vanilla. Does it take 12 hours to reconfigure? So that half of the time it's gonna be worse than the vanilla, or it only takes 30 seconds?
Well, that depends on the workforce. So you're just asking how much time is the reconfiguration duration?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
And how much time is for the normal duration?
And also, I guess, with respect to the non-reconfiguration phase.
Exactly.
Because if you reconfigure 1 hour and have 1 hour of non-reconfiguration, it's bad, right?
Right.
But if you have 1 second of reconfiguration and then one hour of non-reconfiguration, it's better, and this doesn't matter much.
Right, yeah. Okay, that's a good question. I don't know the numbers.
Those are important numbers for you to have a different.
Yeah. I think I was hoping you can notice this.
Okay, we have the recording, so you can write later.
Okay.
Yeah, if I can go over to
the... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, just a couple comments I have in the GitLab that you have. It would be nice to have the legends of the different colors. I mean, it's intuitive,
but
probably you should know, like,
I was thinking, I also have the same comment, but I was thinking about an arrow, pointing to the hot areas. Like, these are hot areas and that's spread.
I mean, it's intuitive, but probably not.
Okay. I was thinking of the legend, but there are too many,
probably one.
I think that's a good idea.
Or just have something like from white, which is 0, to black, which is 100. Something like that, just like a little scale.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't have to cite all of them.
Okay.
There are five colors, right?
Okay. Six. Then number 16, you have LVA ranges, but
okay,
you want to know, you want to talk about how you define these ranges. I don't know if that's important at all, but you say that the variance is an LVA range.
Okay.
So what's a range? What?
Okay, yeah. Well, that's the range, the star LV and the RSI for every research in the process.
Okay, so yeah, I don't know if my question makes sense then.
so you need more clarification.
No, I guess your questions are
Questions.
Yeah.
Or our questions.
No, yeah, but I'm not a typical audience.
Yeah, exactly. So should I you know, say it more here, or is this good enough?
I think
it's
Okay.
Okay. So,
yeah.
What's the title?
Up to.
Oh,
great,
up and two, okay.
I use the British.
Yeah, exactly.
What's that?
The British learned and learned, I guess. That's right. Well, we learned
British
and
some
mistakes. Thanks.
So that's, can I call that a five?
Yeah.
I'll try.
The idea of partial determinism.
I didn't get it.
I know it was important.
So, I have a general suggestion is that you be too fast on the initial slide.
Yeah.
So the motivation is to be more forward with a longer talk than your actual motivation.
I have
hard time understanding what you said in the graph because you didn't explain the initial graph, not the last data graph.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand why the initial graph.
Okay. So motivation needs to be explained more.
Yeah, and well, about the partial determinism again, well, I guess it's the same question. How do you measure the
partial determinism?
And more, no, I mean...
Can you explain partial determinism? What do you mean by partial?
More is good, right?
Well,
Partial determinism meaning
a set of non-sequential blocks, which is more than one. So in this case, if the block sequence occurred more than once in a week, then we included that in the result. So
how do you calculate
double increase the number?
Yes, so that increases the partial determinism.
So this thing gives you an idea of how sequential the loop. This just shows how
that even the random axes can be deterministic.
They are repeated.
They're repeated.
It's how predictable is the model? It's like you are doing this, and up just stack it to this, doing this sort of thing, and stack it to this.
So you can say they have the same partial determinism in random axes.
Okay.
So what do you mean by that?
So you should say, well defined term, so you can say something like, when you show the table with partial determinism on the bottom, say partial determinism measures the number of coherence in the same way, something like this, whatever is your definition, because it's not an obvious definition.
Okay.
So there will go something like predictability or something like that, and then you can use a parameter, a metric for predictability that would be partial determinism, it can be well defined.
Okay.
So why do you say that performance improves when actually performance degrades in slide 26, 25? Oh, overall decrease. So I think you said increase and the bullet it says decrease.
Decrease in the busy time.
Decrease?
Oh.
In fact, you also said that the performance is better, which is not true. The performance is actually worse.
But, oh no, no, this is the overall decrease in the busy times for cumulative and partial cases, including the normal ones.
Because the graph does not show me any decrease and the bullet shows me a decrease.
No, here only for the non-reconfiguration series there is a decrease of 14 to 35 and 5 to 39.
So you talk about non-reconfig in this slide.
Right. And then this is the reconfiguration. And then the overall decrease in the disk busy time.
It's still somewhere with that, on the center, the reconfiguration phase.
Yeah, I think your slides have to be a little bit more self-contained because some of the information is you're speaking it out, but if someone is not paying attention to each word you say and they're just looking at your slides, they should also have some context. You know, so look at each slide and see if the slide is more or less self-contained or not.
So if you know sometimes you have the text that you could have spoken, but you're missing text that you should put. For instance, you should put all the parameters of the experiment and what it acts to, but you don't have to write, we see that the performance increases, so you can speak.
Okay. So you mean the experimental setup?
Yes, exactly. You have to know the setup and what is the, for instance, the, in the temporal locality, I don't understand the, what is the y-axis.
Yeah, I have to.
Because
the same problem as the partial
determinant. Because you know, people have a rough idea what these things mean, but there is no definition of you know what the formula we use.
Right.
So you have to put all this in written, but then you can talk about you know observations that are not necessarily to be written. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wanted to know how. I mean, what are the number of requests and these are right and these requests and those these?
Oh, that's from this. That is for the web server. In this,
For this.
Oh no, the number of requests for the week long were about 1.1 million, which 250,000.
No, I mean just to have an idea, this overlap thing, how big it is, because I was trying to see. Okay, can we fit this in memory? That was.
For the web server? No, because the file system access, so these are the only things in writing the entire this long still from the memory.
On a week. So on a day will be less than a week.
Yes, but I haven't included the unique access here, but
okay.
They're higher in the
You have
to, I think, at least for the give some space after the question before you answer it, because that will give you an opportunity to interpret it. So your question was, why can't we fit those overlapping working sets in memory?
In memory, yeah.
So what is the right answer to that? I think the right answer to that is to say that we already have a memory cache, which is completely utilized. And the IO traces that we observe here are those that cannot fit in the memory, and that's why I had to go to this in the first. Okay. So the memory is already used.
Right.
It's not that we're not using memory.
I think that question there is definitely
going to ask something like
because
that.
Every time we do this presentation, someone has asked questions.
Okay.
But you should write that down.
Okay, so I have another question, but more like an analysis of the question. So my question is, if now you are optimizing or increasing the tick time and rotation of the my question is why, and actually this is happening in OSDI, why if you do something like this, if you can instead change the device for a flash device and eliminate the rotation delay and delay?
Or to put the question in other words, is that will your work be as valuable as it is? To this, to a flash device?
Is that a question?
My question is why don't you replace your disk and with a flash device and you eliminate the rotational delay and see delay?
Okay. Well, for one thing, flash drives are more expensive. So, disk drives are still the most popular form of secondary storage devices.
Okay, that's a good answer.
Flash drives are expensive, they cannot store longer data. Which means even if you were to use flash device, you can say that we believe flash device will form another layer of storage in the hierarchy between disk and memory. You would have the same problems now with IOs that miss from the flash device.
But you could
say something like that.
But we could use flash as also too.
Yeah, you could also say that will potentially we could use a flash type device for as the Borg OPT partition. The concerns of sequential reads no longer exist.
Yeah.
Because random reads are as effective as sequential reads. But we kind of think about other optimizations to make right sequential reads.
So is it RT?
30.
You say that in the BOPT site summary,
uh-huh.
is the performance improved with increasing time and stabilizers when on but I would rather guess that your performance can degrade if your partition size is too long.
Degrade if your partition size.
Because in that case, the you want to store everything in a small partition, right? To confine your seek into a very small state instead of a large state. That's your whole goal.
Right, but even if so we can just choose the DOPT size when the performance stabilizes. We don't have to choose the maximum size of the DOPT. So your question is if the DOPT size is really large.
Yeah, then I would rather guess that your performance may degrade.
Because there'll be less of co-location, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and you have to traverse a long portion of the disk.
Well, the partition, the VOPT partition is like 5-10% of the total disk space. So it is still a very small section of the disk space, so it will still restrict the head movement in that section. So by large sizes, I don't mean like 50% of the disk space, up to 10%.
You always feel the BOPT?
Always feel the BOPT?
Yes.
That depends on the tray. If there are more blocks in the tray, or more frequent density, then it is going to follow the size and all the disk caches. It's a few blocks in a
week. And I just to have an opportunity would be like a couple of G.
What?
The size of the actual data you have in the BOPT.
The BOPT size itself is about, I think the maximum size we're using is 7.2 gigabytes. Of which 40% of the data.
Gigabytes. And you feel it, you don't have to feel it.
When you say 40%, you did so many different experiments. We also did a sensitivity analysis.
Right, but I'm not including the sensitivity. It was for the experiments that we did, not the sensitivity.
40% was all in all experiments we used.
40% up to 40% meaning the maximum was 40% in the rest of the
experiments. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, if you pick a number, it becomes hard for someone to understand why you picked that number. You can say we varied it in this range.
Okay.
For these different experiments, then you are safer, I think.
Okay.
You are
so fielding
off other questions in that direction.
So we varied it between 5 to 40% of the
people. Yeah, I mean, in all cases, what I want to be sure is that you cannot fill this popular data on memory, or let's say if I buy an extra gig of memory, can I do way better than this?
Right, but again, that is... it also depends. If you buy an extra 1 week of memory.
You're saying, well, I'm giving up. Okay, you're right.
So, Mehta, weeks out of how many data? How long is your data partition? Or the data be? How large?
How big is the size of the hard disk?
It was between.
Size of the data set or the hard disk?
Hard disk, maybe.
Yeah, you have that information in your drastic when you have pulse system size.
Yeah, but that's the pulse system size. So this size was between 30 to 250
gigahertz. So how does the performance change with the VOCC size? Is there any graph that says...
There is, but there are too many graphs.
Because as I think for all experiments you use 2 gigabytes, right? For BOPT.
No, it's different for different experiments. Like for the web server, it's 8 gigabytes. For the web server, for instance, it's 8 gigabytes.
So I think
you say that?
I don't say that.
So I'm glad to say you can say that we experiment with different sizes. But then some use cases for every workload you have to experiment by the right size.
Well, you say that in the conclusion that the automated configuration of these parameters.
But if you give a bigger size than what the optimal size, it can work.
It can become worse because if you have a bigger size for the OPT.
For the VOPT, yeah.
Yeah, use VOPT instead of OPT.
Yes.
Yeah. OPT is a different or you?
No, it's the same thing actually.
We have to rename it because
VOPT.
Sorry. If you have a problem with OPT. And you should change it to VOPT.
Yeah, why not just use the large OPT? VOPT. And not have to deal with the size configuration for VOPT.
Well, as long as all the blocks can be contained in the VOPT, fine, but then you cannot even increase the size up to, I mean, large size meaning up to what percent of the total power system size, because then you'll be using up or wasting space.
But if you don't care about the space, then bigger size.
But then you,
cannot count
you but right? Then the point here is also to restrict the head movement, so you don't want the partition to be really large.
Okay.
I think that's not the answer. I think what answer you should give is that the size of the VOPT is going to directly impact how much data you move. If you increase the size, you're potentially moving more data.
No, that is true. But if your size is way more than the data set, then you're wasting space there.
So it all depends on the traces. If your traces are multi-leaf traces, then you could be filling your VOPT all the time. And your VOPT may contain data which is not used at all, never again. So you spend time moving data into the OPT, which is never used. So you have to also take into account the reconfiguration mode, the amount of time you will need to fill up a VOPT, which is of a larger size. There is a trade-off that we need. The other thing which you need to say is that you use some sort of thresholds to determine from the master access graph which blocks to actually include in the VOPT. We do not place all the vertices of the master access graph, which would happen if you did not have the threshold for edge weight. If your VOPT is large enough, you put everything in the master access graph into the VOPT, although some of that data may not be important to keep in the VOPT.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would recommend is that instead of trying to answer immediately, which is great, if you have the right answer all the time, I think that's almost impossible. You might want to, you know, take a few seconds to analyze the question so you can come up with the best possible answer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what I heard that also is good to, sometimes it's good to repeat the question in your own words, just to check that you actually are answering the right question.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's important because some of these questions are very easy to misinterpret.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to ask the question again. And sometimes the audience also appreciates that because then they also understand the question better. Mm-hmm.
So, well, I have a question about the presentation. So, second, in this slide, you said that current configuration can improve performance up to 80% in the last line, right?
Yes.
So, in the conclusion, you said this is time reduction ranges from 6% to 50%. So why do you have difference in that 80% and that 50%?
Oh yeah, that's a good question. Okay.
Can you change the statement in the next slide to then have not a conflict in the
Which one is wrong? The first one or the second?
No, it's not wrong. It's just
the different numbers.
Yeah, and that's because we did the sensitivity analysis after the experiment.
What's the
and then we used the best.
Time, by the way.
it's the time that this is actually doing the IO.
How do you
mean?
What is
the
difference?
Huh?
From what to?
Well, that's the actual disk utilization time.
You get it from the device?
In the device.
But that B to C, they are summing of B to C for all the requests, right?
It's the sum of B to C times?
For all the requests.
It's the sum of B to C times for all the requests. No, we don't use the B to C times.
So how do you get it?
Well, you can hold it.
From the application point of
view.
We did use
the time it takes IO, the IO completion time. This busy time, how would you measure different busy time?
Yeah, that's
what it is. Okay, this would be, okay, yeah, I was thinking of the IO scheduler. Okay, yeah.
You have to say the sum of the time that this is going on.
I think what you need to do is to explain that metric better. One of my comments was that you said average disk busy time, but it's not. Disk busy time is not clear to me. I have to clarify that further.
Yeah, well,
and you can say that how we measured it. We measured it by capturing or by monitoring the time at which the request was issued, each request was issued, and when it was completed, and then we took a sum of all those times.
Okay. Issued the device.
I think especially a metric which is going to be used over and over again in all the graphs, we have to be very clear about when you're introducing the metric.
And you said that we didn't explain.
The good thing about this presentation is you have only one metric.
Mm-hmm.
So you can spend a few seconds talking about that.
So one question that I had is, so if your working set size is bigger than your OPT partition, then wouldn't you be performing worse? Since you will be moving, your head will be moving between the board partition and the pulses.
Well, that would happen for.
You can take a few seconds, and I'll like it.
Okay.
So you can repeat the question.
Okay, so the question is, if the working set size is larger than the OPT, that would degrade the performance.
Of the VOPT, yeah.
Of the VOPT, that would degrade the performance. that depends on the workload, because if it's the right workload, if it's the right intensive workload, the IO would still be absorbed in the VOPT and so it would still improve performance, but in case of weak performance, it could degrade the performance.
That's not
all.
VOPT is smaller than VOPT.
I think the question is, if it's way smaller than the working
set.
It's smaller.
Okay, yeah. In most cases, it is smaller than the working set size.
What were the working set sizes that you used? Say, for instance, in the best of the world.
Well, I don't have the total. These are the total reads in the write.
No, there's a working set size, pulse set size. Yeah.
Pulse set size is just the
working set size. Yeah, it doesn't mean it's a working set size.
Wasn't
that
the data access?
The first one?
Yeah.
Although she said that, but that's not.
Did I say that?
You said that the file system, the first column is all the data that was accessed in the file system. That's what you said. And one of my comments was that that's not true.
Okay. No, it's the total size of the file system. The worst thing size would be the unique from using the right speech. I don't have numbers.
The total reads and writes do not tell you about the whole.
Yeah, no.
So you might, I mean, what are the second and third columns being used here for?
Well, just to show which should read intensive and writing.
Right. So you might also, where do you talk about the working set in the last graph?
Working set.
Or the portion of the file system access, percentage of file system access. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, here.
That's where you go. Then you need to calculate it based on the percentage number and the previous number.
Okay. Yeah.
What's your indicator of popularity or hot slot?
The frequency. The frequency of, so we don't actually find the popularity of hot slot. We find the popularity of the access pattern. It's not a single block, it's an access pattern. That is why we create the graph based on the first circle.
So going back to Gavin's question about does performance degrade if the size of the DOPD is smaller than the size of the one? What was the final answer to that?
She said that if it's read intensive, it will degrade, and if it's write intensive, the writes will be absorbed by the DOPD.
What about the change in the sequentiality in the DOPD? So even if not all the blocks are in the DOPD, the blocks which are there are possibly accessed more sequentially.
Right, but if the DOPD size is really small compared to the working set size, then you could still have larger head movements and that could still be good performance.
So what you can say is that, I mean, we did sensitivity analysis for the size of the DOPD. Did we have a negative performance improvement at some point?
For the DOPD size, I wouldn't think so. No, not for the DOPD size.
I think the negative was for
the reconfiguration interval, and there's something for the DOPD size also.
So you can use that data to answer these.
Yes, for the DOPD size, if size was smaller for the developer workload, there was a negative value because of the degradation in the repo form.
So what you should probably have is those graphs in the backup slide, as part of the backup slide. Even if you don't present it, although I would suggest that you present.
Yeah, I wanted to, but I thought there would be too many graphs and there wouldn't be enough time to, you know, because again it's a new metric, we use throughput there.
Yeah.
I mean, again we'll have to explain.
I prefer graphs in the text.
Yeah, that was very complicated. That slide was very hard.
Yeah, I mean, that the other problem with this slide, how it was presented, was that the slide is very high level, but then you had a lot of information to present verbally.
Yeah.
But to gauge the conclusion, I had to talk about that information.
But it's very hard for everyone to remember all these numbers. When someone is throwing a lot of numbers at you, I want to look at it in the slide if there is a lot of numbers, because I can look at the same number twice, but I cannot hear the same number twice.
Okay. So I think I should just make three slides here for each of the...
I think that would be easier. In fact, I would say you can discard some other experiment, like the application...
Startup?
Yeah, application startup. You can discard it completely.
Okay.
Not talk about it. And you can say that we did this, and I'm going to only talk about this. And
yeah, also the same with the virtual machine experiment.
Yeah, virtual machine, you
because the
one thing
is that they're going very fast and worse than not putting it. Because things go very fast and you don't explain configuration to what virtual machine.
Yeah, you can put these in the backup slide. Say, okay, if someone has the question where the answer is available in the backup slide, you can go to that slide. You don't have to put all of it in the presentation. So certainly you don't have the time.
So I need the virtual machine slide as well?
I think so, because if you move it, then you create the questions. Like,
what about this one? Then should I talk about this or?
Which one?
This one.
The create replay?
Yeah, the create replay for SCN and developer.
I think that SCN and developer, you're already doing a sensitivity analysis.
Right.
So you could just present the sensitivity analysis for me.
Right. So
this is redundant in a way.
Yeah.
If you want to present many workloads, the only reason to present different workloads is if they have different conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So and you have four workloads, but I didn't see that what's the difference between them. Like, does the board perform better for one or the other? Because, you know, you don't want to see four graphs as the same.
Yeah.
So,
you well, there are slight differences in
select representative workloads that have different behavior. So, did you make any observations that some of the workloads has behaved very different from the rest?
I mean, in the sensitivity graph, there is one data point that shows that what can actually lead to worse performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think two data points there than the vanilla performance. And
I think that's more interesting.
Yeah.
I
think one high-level comment is that there seems to be more breadth in this presentation than in typical presentation. There's a lot of information. I think that leaves the presentation at a high level. So I think you had to pick some content to remove and focus more deeply on the remaining content.
Yes.
I would recommend application, startup profiles, and virtual machine.
So you want to show the most interesting things. You don't want to show everything. I think you don't want to show something that is exciting and people, you know, want to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as I think Vogel is also a very good point that you need to present the configuration parameters in the slide rather than speak it up.
Right, the other way.
And some of those, it's very, when you're saying a lot of, or presenting a lot of numbers, it's not easy for the audience to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So put it in the slide.
Also, when you talk about the graph, it would be nice if you can, you can draw it.
Yeah.
Graph, right? To just a small graph of 10 nodes to an example. Even if you don't talk about it, just to show it. So to get an idea of how the graph looks like.
So I can put the graph and we have in the paper.
Yeah, you can just put it there.
And even for the planner? The placement?
Yeah, it would be a good idea because these two move through really quickly, and I mean, someone might argue that this is sort of the intelligence behind the system, and you know, these are the things you might spend a little bit more time on.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, the whole system architecture part was hard for me to understand.
I think you spent a very little time on this.
The thing is, probably you just explain what each component does, but you didn't give the global picture, so it's hard for the audience to put everything together. So probably what I would suggest you do is just go to one iteration of a board. Okay. So when you insert board, let's say you profile and you look at the I/O activity, and then at some point you start a reconfiguration. So that information goes from the I/O profiler to the analyzer and the planner and so on and so forth.
Okay.
Because it's really hard to see. I mean, the global picture, you just went component by component, say this does this, this does this, this does this, this does this, and this does this.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So the other comment I had was about this slide 18, where you say, you talked about the incoming, leaving, and so on, but it's not in the slide. So
yeah,
it's hard for me to...
Right, but I don't know how to show it in the... pictures as well. Also, there's so much information in the pictures.
Yeah, you can remove the map from there
and
show a plan, you know, sequence of plan operations with incoming, leaving, which goes and feeds into the reconfigurator, because that's really what goes. You don't feed the plan into the reconfigurator. Sorry, you don't feed the map into the reconfigurator.
Right.
So you say write plan and read plan, but you put a map in there.
Right.
So then you can put incoming, leaving, and all that in the slide itself, so that when you talk about it, people are not lost.
So how do I show a plan then?
But yeah, I told you what plan. No, no, no. It's saying the block of D of FF put in the block B prime of D. That's what I thought.
But is it an incoming or a where are the other relocations?
Yeah. The right relocation. Right.
I think you. you can just take a trace of our communication between the analyzed, the planner and the reconstitutive, where you have eye for incoming and then source destination. Okay. So that you can put that.
Okay.
So you can put dots between.
Yeah, probably animate through that.
Yeah.
What?
And animate through that.
Yeah.
By translation.
I mean, you don't, I mean, just like you have dots over there, okay, that's where the rest of it is. You show a section of the incoming, you know, leaving, and then the relocate, and then the incoming. So you can show a plan by showing some of the entries of each state.
Probably that's too much, right? The point is too much detail. I mean,
but if you talk about it, it should be on the slide. That's the, yes. You have to have, if you say incoming, there has to be something to say what's going on.
What if I just add another column there with the characters?
Okay, so then that's...
So, but then, yeah,
it's
a table.
Yeah, that's fine.
Operation or whatever.
Yeah.
And then A prime and incoming.
What about relocate?
And then B prime and the relocate. Stop
relocates have no FL context at all. They are OBD mostly.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, you have to change this somehow.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I think this is going to be more complex than just listing the plan itself. But it's up to you. But this one seems like a map to me rather than a plan. So, that's a bit confusing. And somewhere you have to talk about incoming, relocate, and leaving in this slide, if you're going to talk about that.
Yeah, I thought about that after your comment, but I'm not sure how to represent this in the picture.
I can draw it for you.
Okay, so well, there is a reconfiguration block somewhere, copyright, something like that.
What
there is a reconfiguration going on.
Yeah.
What happens with request, normal request?
Yeah, so
do we
don't talk about that.
No, I didn't talk about it. So normal request to the block that is being reconfigured or?
Normal requests that are not being reconfigured go directly, or how
they
do you know that?
Directly to the system.
And blocks that are being moved around?
I didn't talk about it in this presentation.
So there may be a question, what do you do with foreground workload when you're doing reconfiguration? I think there should probably be a slide about that.
Consistency.
Addressing consistency.
Okay. So then there won't be too many slides. Maybe. Because I didn't talk about the implementation issues at all.
So you can talk about just the consistency part, not the other part. Just talk about consistency. Because consistency is an important issue which a lot of people will have concerns with. So if you don't talk about it at all, you can expect a lot of questions for Q&A.
Okay.
If you want to preempt it, I would suggest putting us one slide that talks about consistency.
I'll put the question somewhere rather than putting everything in there.
Then put a backup slide.
The indirection algorithm is then, if you have a copy of the request, you go to the OPC location.
Right.
Always.
Yes.
If you have a copy, you always go to the OPC.
Yes.
There's nothing more about sequentiality or maybe losing something where you are.
No.
If there is
no,
a copy, you
no,
go.
No, it doesn't depend on the head position, it always goes to the OPC.
And wouldn't be used, I mean, couldn't you be losing sequentiality or something? Did you considering more information?
So again, we have that information about partial attributes, which I won't put here.
No, but I mean,
you don't have to refer
to the paper. You can answer the question based on the material in the paper.
It's
very hard to put everything in on the paper in the presentation, but there may be questions for any part of the paper, right?
Yes,
so you
but this, I think this is probably a good question, which is. Which can be expected to so make a better slide for this, right? So we have the three cases where the request is completely in the OPC or in the OPC and partially in the OPC translation or only in the OPC translation.
How it can be
accessed for each of those conditions.
Did you answer the question? I didn't mean.
Yeah, I didn't hear an answer.
Yeah, so if it's partially in the OPT and partially in the SS, then you service whatever in the OPT from OPT and the remaining portion from OPT.
So the answer, so what you're saying is that you wouldn't lose sequentiality because most of the requests are big requests. And whenever there is an incomplete, whenever the request is not completely on the OPT, you won't go piece by piece. You are piece here, not piece here. No.
Well, as far as I remember, I think I'm not confused in excess.
Just please buy
it. But I think if the pages are clean, okay, you don't have to redirect all. You don't have to redirect parts of request to the OPT. But instead, you read the whole thing from the FS, which won't affect the sequentiality.
But I think that was an earlier design, and then you changed it because it was complicating something.
No, actually, not. I remember it implemented some work. I don't know if it's connected
yeah,
or
no,
the board.
So the way that, so you have a request that you have some pages that are in the OPT and some pages that are not on the OPT, right? So if the pages are in the OPT but are in the OPT are clean, you redirect the whole request to the FS. But if the pages that are in if some pages that are in the OPT are dirty, you have to read the pages that are dirty from the OPT and read the pages that you don't have from in the OPT from the FS.
Okay. So in general, I mean, doesn't matter if it's dirty or you clean the things that you don't have all the requests in the OPT.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have only pieces, you go to the FS.
If you have only pieces, you
and
go to the FS. Unless it's dirty.
Unless
it's dirty.
Yeah, because the FS have an old version.
An old version.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So your question was, if I have a clean version in the OPT and a clean version in the FS,
yeah,
and should I redirect based on current headquarters?
Yeah, I mean, not exactly. My question is, always moving to the OPT, if you have it on the OPT, why is that the best choice?
Yeah, so that certainly can be argued, and the way I would answer that question is that we expect most of the ASCII's to be in the OPT, and to make our solution simple, we just redirect it. If we capture the working set well in the OPT and we absorb all the writes in the OPT, we expect that the head will spend a lot of time in the OPT.
Well, and I guess you could also add that because of the existing, I mean, this is what will happen in the existing implementation, right? In the future, if we implement automated reconfiguration based on the changes in the working sets, then, you know, which follows from heuristic. Then it will probably do a reconfiguration if the performance begins to degrade. Right?
Yeah, the timing on the reconfiguration.
Yeah. So.
How is that related to the heuristic?
Well, so his question was the performance could degrade if you move the head between the OPT and the file system all the time.
I didn't know about it, but my question is why did you use this algorithm? Because there was no choice, right?
Point.
Yes, this point.
I think the other question, I mean, there are several other questions that you can think of from the audience. So one is, well, why did you use this specific analysis and planning algorithm? Did you try other algorithms?
No,
mm-hmm.
We didn't try we just used, I don't know, in the earlier version we used the C minor algorithm. That was
for what would happen if you specify the blocks to go to the OPT based on assuming a smaller size cache and using LRU or ARS or something like that.
Yeah,
what will be wrong, whether you want to capture the actual. Why not teaching the most used, the most frequently used blocks and putting those in the OPT?
The most frequently used blocks?
Let's say just a count.
But then you would use
in any order.
In any order. Yes.
Yeah, that is one, that could be one possible way of I think, but in this case you'll be just co-locating the data. You may not necessarily increase the sequentiality. So it may not perform as
the objective is to increase sequentiality, and because that's the best the hardware itself.
So if you have, if you just mine individual blocks, then you don't know the access pattern.
So what you mean is that you have these.
And
you have this, right? What you were saying all the time is that you have the blue, the black squares that are highly active things, so you put all the black things on the OPT partition,
yes.
And what you want to maintain is the exact order of the
right.
of the black portions.
Right.
Among the black portions and within the black.
That's the partial term. So
you're not reducing big time, but also protection of data.
Yeah.
So the other question would be, how does board work with journaling process? Let's first write the one to the journal and then the static notation. Do you have this problem that first you write to the board partition, simulate the write there, and then to the journal, and finally to the static notation? Are you creating a lot more work then? Because the journal is already optimized for writing sequence. So how does all of this interact?
Well, you can filter out the journal by interfering it in the journal and
so wouldn't that lead to head movement then? If you're moving between your PT and the journal?
So you're saying that instead of the journal, you just assimilate it inside board?
No, just that. Okay. The question is, if you're first going to write to the board partition, and then to move it to the journal, and then finally to the static location, because that seems like a lot of work.
Right, so you can filter the journal request from board partition. Because journal passes from a right to the journal.
Then there are two questions. How do you find out which data is being written to journal versus other data? And wouldn't that also lead to more head movement? Because earlier the head movement was restricted to the OPT partition, now it's in two locations, one in the OPT and the other one.
Well, we can co-locate the journal with the OPT partition to reduce the head movement.
So one of the things that could be of answer to this is that if the journal is, the typical journal size is small, which is usually, I don't know, about 128 megabytes or 25 megabytes. And that circular journal is going to get filled up at a much faster rate than we move things out of the PT. So, which means that in most cases, you never write to journal at all. Most of the data that you typically write to journal, you don't write to journal. They get written to a PT and then finally to the static location. In fact, even writing to the static location gets written inside the OPT.
So why doesn't
it
get written to the
journal? Because you overwrite the journal location while it is in the OPT.
So you are still overwriting the journal location?
you are not overwriting the journal location. You're writing the OPT location, which is the proxy for the journal location.
Okay.
So it is not true that one each journal entry gets written twice. Earlier it was written twice. It's not true that the blog is write each journal entry twice. Only twice, because
probably you would write some.
A portion of the OPT would act as a proxy for the journal automatically. You're not actually writing the journal written? No, it's all being written to OPT.
Yeah.
All the rights are going to be whatever consistency. Consistency is the same because the file system will access the journal as if it's accessing the journal. It says that it will now read from the OPT. So the BOPT is acting as a proxy for the journal.
When the system crashes, it will lose both journals as well as OPT.
So when the system crashes, the file system will read from journal, but the board will redirect all those reads to the BOPT.
Oh, okay. So the mapping is persistent.
Nothing is persistent. Yeah.
So whenever you have a write, you have also a write to the map.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Only. So a write is to the map.
No. I'm not a write.
Remember, you have to change the map.
So, in Borg, you don't differentiate between metadata and data.
No. Borg does not know about metadata. They cannot differentiate.
How do you have to process information about the metadata? Because in XCC,
you don't need
a
metadata.
Yeah.
Or
you
need
to when you do the application profiling, you may do the application context, right? Because all the metadata are written by K, R, and D.
Yeah, that's a good question.
So, for example, a metadata intensive operation, you can have profile, right? Then, because everything would be done by K, R, and D. Not the output of a web server thread, or document.
So, you wouldn't identify the process associated with that?
No, it will be K journal D.
Right.
K journal D is like any other process in the system. It has its own characteristics, it has its own behavior. It writes sequentially to a journal location and reads from the journal and distributes it to the file system. The K journal D is just treated as any other process. Yeah. So, with its own independent characteristics.
So, in the IO, when you're tracing IO, most of the writes that you will get are from PD plus instead of from the process that originated that write. So wouldn't that mess up access pattern?
That's an evil question.
I don't think I've anyone from the audience
You never know.
I mean,
there are exceptions to the rule.
There's one guy, one smart guy who probably read the entire paper three times.
So again, it's from a, I should say non-expert because you're also an author in the paper. Do you see any other
So my question is, what happens if you have multiple users? Can you still use Borg, or then the partial determinism disappears and there is nothing you can do?
Well, we use Borg, and we do evaluate multi-user.
So you found that there is partial determinism for.
Right, because we have
the
based on the
problem. The workloads you have are multi-user.
Huh?
The workloads you have are multi-user?
The SVN and the web server are multi-user.
I think you need to answer the question about why, then say,
right.
Well, in our experiments, we also found that.
When you would describe the workload, you should say which ones are single-user and which ones are multi-user.
I mentioned it, but I didn't put it on the slide.
Probably the point about there is that you said that since you're tracing an access pattern.
It's at the block layer. So
and those are block layer, and those will be, and most access patterns will be captured by Borg. So what you will actually be doing now is that since
previously used it for accessing different parts of the hard drive. Now they're most of their accessing will be in the board OPC partition instead of throughout the
So does the
question about partition?
Yeah, so the partial determinism
is
there, but it's less or
the
same?
No, the partial determinism. The partial determinism is just a sequence of sequential blocks. So there are two. So that is independent of the number of users. It just depends on the workflow that the users are executing or the applications they're using. So
you have to say that the partial determinism is computed on a per process level. For each process, you compute where the repeated action is.
Yeah.
So the edges between the LP ranges are created for each process specifically.
And that is
you have n users, and each user may have n applications. So look at each application separately to derive partial determinism.
Right.
So that it is therefore independent of the actual number of users as well as the number of processes.
Okay.
So one question I have is, do you know this in terms of the process ID or in terms of the process name?
I would recommend that you read the board paper like 3 or 4 times before your presentation, because a lot of details you can make this presentation delivery more rich by having those details at your fingertips, so that you can derive on that when you are presenting a certain piece of information.
Mm-hmm.
You can just add on these details. If these are second nature to you, that it becomes much easier when you're talking about them. Otherwise, I think one of the things that I saw was that you were sort of delivering it as a job, right? I mean, this is a task that I need to get through. So I think if you have more information, you will yourself be more excited about your content and delivering that in a more animated and excited way. So that makes a lot of difference, right, for an audience. If you are excited, then the audience is also motivated to be excited about your work. And for you to be excited, you should have all these nice details to draw upon for each slide that you present.
I was about to make the same point. What I see from our presentation is he sometimes forgets those details.
And then, when you lack those details, you're not excited. You need all those details to excite yourself. So read the paper many, many times before you make the final presentation. But having all that information will make your own presentation to you more exciting. I think we should stop now, right?
Yeah, conditioning is horrible.
You're feeling hot?
Yeah.
It was what happened. I talked to Steve about it, but then I think he didn't ever say that.
Well, we had this conversation a long time back with Catherine, and basically she says that this tool cannot be improved. It doesn't have any ventilation.
So be patient until you got it.
That's a freedom.
Or you can come and sing it.
We can make it very quick.
Okay, guys, have a nice sleep and
good
luck tonight. Bye. Thank you. Bye.
So,
are we having the pictures of the
phone? Yes.
Oh, behind the presentation.
Can I read in the SPC?
Yes,
yeah.
You should
send me a picture.
Oh, sorry. I wasn't
back.
Sorry.
So,
I think I should put the pictures of all the people attending first.
Okay.
All the authors attending first.
No, I was telling Mary was to put the pictures of
But you can't find a picture of Sam.
Yeah. Yeah, please look at all the comments and the slides, Madam.
Yes.
Carefully look at all the slides.
Oh, I had a question for you. In this the temporal locality graph, do you have the data for the graph? Because I need to explore it for the y-axis maybe. And I can find it on the FCM.
The data is not there?
I can find it. Otherwise, it's in a different firewall folder.
It might be in the OSDI version. Did you look at the OSDI?
No, I just looked at that.
Okay. So check in the OSDI if you find the data.
Okay.
If not, send me an email, I'll post it. Because I remember that most of the data that I used for this paper were all OSDI data.
Okay.
So there were really no changes.
Okay, yeah.
And the heat lab and everything are all part. I added that to the OSDI version because I didn't want to have half the data in one and have more longer.
Okay.
So look at the OSDI data directory.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, I think the key is to, read the paper a lot of times. Make your presentation a little bit more depth and removing some of the parts of the presentation.
Okay,